Welcome. Retreat, silent retreat, is all about time, the open expanse of time. But time tends to make us anxious. The sense of unstructured, open time without busyness tends to send the mind racing a bit. And so maybe you notice this phenomena. Something I notice is that maybe if I enjoy when I have a very unstructured day. It's not so common that there's not a lot of commitments in one kind or another. But then in the face of that openness, that open expanse of time, I kind of scaffold stuff in there, even if it's like not too meaningful. I'm like, I'll take a walk then, and then I'll eat lunch, and then I'll, you know, maybe a cup of coffee, or, you know, it's just like just blocking things out. And then it feels like, okay, yeah, that's a good day. Yeah. And in retreat, we give you, you know, sit, walk, sit, walk, sit, walk, whatever. But the truth is, like, we just do that because people would get really freaked out if we put a blank sheet of paper that just said, awake. Right? Like, but this is what we're here to do. Yeah. And so on the one hand, I bring this up because some of you are brand new to retreat, and it feels like a genuine risk and a kind of, you know, this is actually a big commitment to be in silence for 3 days. And some of you have spent months, you know, cumulatively years in silence. And so for the people who are brand new, you're going to make it. And for the people who have sat a ton, you're going to make it too, but the suggestion is to really let go into the form for all of us to the extent we can. You know, we get in that mindset of budgeting the time out and just make it to, you know, if I just make it through that sit and then I'll rest and then I'll, you know, and then I'll nail the 2:30 sit, and then it's like practically the Dharma talk, and, you know, and then just repeat, and this thing's over, you know. Just watch the mind's tendency, yeah? Because 2 days can be like that, or 2 days, who knows how long, how much, how rich 2 days can be. Yeah. Who knows what we'll find. And so, one of the kind of basic orientations of this practice is really we're not here to turn ourselves into some big self-improvement project. Right? That's a little bit of how we work sometimes with the formlessness of time. We sort of set a kind of agenda, and we essentially, kind of the frame of in our mind is that there's some that I have problems and I'm here to solve them in some way, or I'm the problem and I'm here to solve them, solve myself. But the encouragement here is actually much simpler. We don't need to turn ourselves into a kind of self-improvement project, but instead to look in a very simple way that we'll talk about, to look in this very simple way and to be willing to be surprised, to be willing to be surprised by ourselves, by the heart, by the silence. And in an important way, this is the beauty of the Dharma, is that it can't actually be mapped out in advance. Our insights, we try to plan out our insights, right? Like, we try to map out the trajectory of our healing. But the very nature of insight is that it's surprising. And we don't actually know when it's coming. It arises out of the continuity of our attention. As Alexis's teacher, Sayadaw Tejaniya, says, like, when you read a book, you don't skip chapters, right? If you skip chapters, it's hard to actually understand the narrative arc. And the same thing with ourselves. When we skip chapters, when we miss out, on things that are going on inside of us, the learning gets compromised in some way. We can't see ourselves so clearly. And so we want to nurture this simple act of curiosity, of openness, and this kind of willingness to explore and rediscover a kind of magic mystery of awareness. Have a 2-year-old nephew and sometimes take care of him, and when he wakes up from a nap, if he's like got enough sleep and is well rested, he's very calm when he wakes up, and I don't know exactly what's going on inside of him, but it looks like, it has the feel of like he's rediscovering the wonders of being alive. He's like taking the world in this very slow way and like seeing again what it's like to be aware. Now, maybe that's just my huge meditation teacher projection on my poor 2-year-old nephew, but that's what it looks like. He's like, and it reminds me of what we're doing. It reminds me of what we're doing. So the beat poet Lew Welch said, "Step out onto the planet, draw a circle 100 feet round. Inside the circle are 300 things nobody understands, and maybe nobody's ever really seen. How many can you find?" To support this practice of looking, try to make the environment very inviting in some ways and comfortable, but also very simple. There's some level of renunciation in being here, of letting go of phones and various kind of small entertainment and small pleasures, and this spirit of renunciation is quite important, actually, quite central to what we're doing, in a way, because we want to see what our mind does when it's robbed of its normal outlets for distraction and agitation. That makes sense? Like, what? See, when we're act, and I'm not coming from the dais here. I'm not coming from the high horse here. I know this habit in myself quite well. Because we have so many ways of actually acting out agitation in the world, of reaching in one way or another for pleasure, it's actually very difficult to see the mechanisms of craving and the ways that craving binds us in a way. But here, we get real simple and we give up all of that, not to deprive ourselves or punish ourselves, but actually so we can see the mechanisms of craving and letting go more clearly. So this is Ajahn Amaro, it's a Thai British in the Thai forest tradition, who actually taught a retreat here. So he says, "The fact that the Buddha was a monk gets lost. Of course, people are free to practice as they want. Nonetheless, many Western Dharma centers seem to marginalize renunciation, which is vital to the whole process of Dharma practice and enlightenment. It's like opening up the chest, detaching all the veins and arteries, carefully removing the heart, and maintaining the body on a life support system. One can't help but wonder, is this thing really alive? Is this really going to carry on? Obviously, my perspective is slanted. I'm a card-carrying monk. But in wedging Dharma teachings into a comfortable life, one may be missing something that's crucial to the teachings of the Buddha. I would suggest that people look closely at that. Is the Dharma something that I tack onto my life, or is it something that I offer myself up to? It's just like nature. Do we see it as a pretty and refreshing adjunct to my world, or do we see that all that we are, mentally and physically, is inescapably part of nature? When you relinquish control and take on the simplicity of the renunciate life, you have the opportunity to reflect on all the things to which you've become habituated. You take on restrictions in order to contact the most profound dimension of your nature." One last thought, which is that something that echoing what was said in the hall, the community hall downstairs, that we're doing this together, like really, like not like I'm just saying that so we can feel like one team, like we're really doing this together. And because the teachers sit up here and are talking more, the energy and kind of projection goes to the teachers, and it feels like the teachers are sort of running things, and the Sangha, you're the audience. But that's a real misunderstanding of what's happening. And what we can do as teachers depends very deeply on what you're doing as practitioners. It's a dependent, a retreat is a dependent co-arising, meaning that what happens and the beauty that's generated, the goodness that's generated, it arises in because of all the ways we're each contributing. And so the sincerity of our practice is really in service of our own well-being and learning and growth, and also the sanghas. And we'll feel that, I think, as the days go on. We'll feel the ways that the practice of others supports, props up each of us. And part of that kind of mutual commitment and support is in the form of ethics that Alexis will mention in a few minutes, a kind of commitment to honoring the sense of to actually fostering a sense of safety in community. And so we'll take some make some commitments around ethics and as a way of actually supporting this beautiful co-arising.
Matthew, excuse me. Is the sound on? Can you hear me? Is it okay? So, Matthew was speaking a bit about time, how we get impacted by time, and I was noticing that he ended exactly at 8 o'clock. And so, even though time seems to be held loosely, in some ways, being on retreat, wanting to hold it loosely, Dharma teachers get very punctual. Very good. So, a lot of what happens on the retreat in this container, there's a lot of it is not really visible. And Matthew was mentioning the coming together as a group. And we sometimes don't even recognize the power that that has, that we are in this field together, that we are all of us applying our energy, our attention, our intention to be here in ways that are of great service to ourself and to our own life journey that we find ourselves in. One of the ways that we're supported also is this sense of this being a refuge. This is a safe space. I remember the first time I really got it in the Dharma, that I really got that I was safe, that everything was allowed in terms of experience, inner experience, every thought, every emotion, that I wasn't wrong, I wasn't broken, I wasn't bad the way I was. I just had a huge meltdown. Like there was this, I no longer needed to hold myself up, prop myself up, perform, present myself. There was this deep intimacy, deep allowing that was so powerful in my experience. And it was just a really subtle shift in attitude. But I, up until that moment, had been really in conflict, I would say, with what my experience was. And that moment had a lot of deep sorrow, deep sadness well up, because there were so many pieces of myself that I hadn't been aware of. So many parts I had been running over, you know, either through speed or dullness or shame, inner shame. And to actually just be present with experience was so powerful. And we only know that for ourselves when we really start to tune into the Dhamma. It's a sense of safety. And one of the ways that we can feel safe is if all parts of ourselves are invited into this space, into the community here. And Matthew and I are both predominantly white. I have a Cuban father, but I mostly feel like I'm in the dominant group. We're both male, cis male, heterosexual mostly. You know, and so by appearance, we wouldn't provide a full range of safety, and yet that is our deep heart intention, is that as much as we can't embody all groups, that we really want to name however it is that you show up in your form, your body, your gender, sexual orientation, cultural heritage, ethnicity, and all of that is part of the Dhamma. And we really can honor that. You know, that includes our own dominant privilege, you know, that's being spoken a lot about in the world today, is that we can become more conscious of the ways that we are in a certain group. That's part of our awakening process, is that we start to really be sensitive and aware of not only our internal experience, but the way in which we manifest in the world, the way our own unconscious tendencies can cause impact. So this can become a very safe space when we're all doing that work together, just being mindful. You know, our normal pursuit of contentment tends to be very outward. And when Matthew was naming the seeing a sunset and the slight pleasure, the joy that comes from that, you said that today, right? I hear so much Dharma these days, I can't remember where it comes from. And you know, so it's just a little example of how we tend to, in our search for contentment and joy and well-being, we take our refuge in a way from things that are not able to give a lasting sense of contentment. Most of our efforts is to find and hold on to things that make us feel good, or the pleasant experiences, or escaping from the inevitable slings and arrows of life. And we're kind of in a treadmill. We're always moving in that way. We're always rushing, leaning into the next moment. So then the moment that's being lived is never a moment that we're really resting in, that we're truly present with exactly how it is. Exactly how it is. And this is where the Dharma is pointing to, when it's really inviting us to this possibility of being free, is this simple quality of mindfulness and awareness is an invitation to begin to rest and turn into our experience and find a contentment that can be with whatever it is that's arising, the full range of our emotions, the unpleasant pains, difficulties in the body, the thoughts that tend to just ruminate and chatter away inside. Can we find ease, a sense of balance, right in the midst of our experience? So that's the invitation. That's what the Buddha endeavored to do, and for 2,600 years, the wheel of the Dhamma has been rolling on. You know, from practitioner to practitioner, we're all now part of that wisdom that is developed through sitting and watching and being with our experience. So traditionally, there's three main refuges that are described: the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the possibility of awakening, waking up to the habits of mind that get us caught, that lead to the agitation and suffering that we get bound into. And the Buddha can really, for our own practice, represent that possibility of our own awakening, that we can do this practice. And we wake up to the Dhamma. The Dhamma is a second refuge. And this is really a true refuge for me. It's refuge in reality, the way things are. And that just really, every time I say the way things are, that has a possibility of being a refuge. I love that. It's not an escape out of pain. It's not a running away. It's not navel gazing, as a lot of people describe meditation. It's really it's this deep courage. Deep courage to be with our own experience. And that when we come to be more and more aligned with the way things are, we're no longer falsely trying to escape experience, assuming that our true contentment will be something other than what's arising. This is taking refuge in the Dhamma. And then the Sangha means community, and that's it's all of us. It's our practitioners. It's also the monastic tradition that has been passing down the teachings. You know, I was very much a loner for a certain period of my practice. When I had gone to Burma to practice, and I was in search of a teacher, and that's where I met my teacher, Sayadaw Tejaniya, that Matthew mentioned. Because it's very easy to take robes there, I decided that I would ordain. And so I was there for about 2 years in the monastic form. You know, it really struck me, because I was still at 28 to 30 years old, and it's a period for me that was a lot about my own self. I can do this on my own. Self-striving. I've got this. I know what I'm doing. And the more I was in the tradition and the Sangha and being with both the monastics and the lay community, Westerners and the Burmese community, I was just so touched. And every time my own obstacles would be surfacing in practice, or I would be doubting the practice, doubting myself, doubting the teacher, doubting the teachings, and I would see someone else sitting there being with their experience, and it just filled me up and gave me this sense, you know, of perseverance. You know, we can do this, and this isn't it isn't a sprint. You know, as much as a weekend retreat, for those of you that haven't done a weekend or a residential retreat before, it may feel as if this is the big one. This is it. A residential retreat. After this, you know, I think I'll have it figured out. You'll figure out some stuff. This is a life practice. You know, we'd learn as we go along. We learn more skills. We learn about our own habits of mind. We learn how to be with our difficulty. But really want to see this as a learning, a training ground. We come together to practice, to hear the Dharma, to apply our own mindfulness and awareness, to see it go away, to be lost, to feel what it's like when it comes back, to get caught in a lot of judgment and doubting. Right, we're seeing these habits of mind and really recognizing that this is the nature of having a mind and a heart, and embodied. This is a discovery, and the Dharma allows us to discover exactly the way we are. And so Matthew mentioned the ethical precepts that form the foundation, also this sense of safety. And this is really more of almost become natural to the mind that grows in understanding. One way that I like to think of, this may be in the canon, I'm not sure, but it was described to me once, is if you take a grain of sand, and if that sand is a reflection of your actions and speech, and you put it into the palm of your hand, now you can kind of feel the weight of it and its texture, but doesn't bother you very much. And then as you were to take that sand and put it into your eye, there would be no doubt that you would feel it, and it would be such an irritant. And this is what happens as our own ethical precepts get developed and our mindfulness grows, as we really begin to see and taste the suffering that comes from actions that cause ourselves harm and that has impact on our family and our friends and our community. So this is a natural refinement, almost without trying. This ethical development takes place and is really a deep foundation that we can rest in. This sense of safety, of trust, that we're here to do important work, and that we've all got a lot of suffering and agitation, and there's a spark of interest in each of our minds, a spark that draws us towards the truth to understand. And there's five primary precepts. These are to refrain from killing, and this applies to even the smallest creatures. We do our best to refrain from taking life so that all beings can feel this sense of safety in our presence. To refrain from stealing or taking that which is not given. And we can really refine that on the level of not moving around things that don't belong to us, and really honor the things that we find around in the center, and that our personal belongings are safe here. To refrain from, in lay life, is to refrain from sexual misconduct. And on the retreat, we take a further refinement of that precept, which is to refrain from acting out any sexual energy. And this is a huge gift, particularly when our energy can spill out in ways, and it's natural, just to say sexual energy is a very natural part, of our mind and body. None of us would be here if it weren't for some sexual energy that had happened at some point in time, so this is nature, it's here. But we also can very easily allow that to spill out with eye contact or moving the body, paying attention in certain ways. So just monitoring your own mind and body, not as a judgment, to just see, can I take care? Can I watch and be with the natural energies of the mind and body? I learned more about sexual energy as a monk when I wasn't, those rules are very strong, where there's so many precepts, 227 precepts in the male, as a monk. For nuns, it's even more. But I learned so much because what I was invited to do was not to avoid and deny what was there, but to simply acknowledge, to be interested, to discover. And I had never known that was possible. I just, sexual energy is there and it takes over the mind, you know. And this is a whole new game when we have this understanding and the teachings, encouragement, that it is possible with whatever experience to be right with it and to become aware in a non-judgmental, allowing field. So that's the invitation with the third precept. Then to refrain from false speech. So after this sitting, we'll have entered into noble silence. As Matthew, I think, pointed out, that silence itself, it's not actually special. I don't believe noble silence is anywhere in the Pali canon. I don't remember seeing the encouragement to be quiet when you're with community. There is a lot of encouragements to seek solitude and to be quiet in that way, but this idea of noble silence is really something that I think has developed in retreat centers over the last few hundred years. And it is a remarkable gift to one another and to yourself. And this silence also extends towards our devices. We are increasingly addicted to the slightest impulse to avoid a moment of boredom or uncertainty. I wish there should be like an app that counts how many times you visit your favorite web page, you know, favorite app, because I'm sure the number of times I visit the same, you know, news site or something is, it gets so high up there. And then by the end of the day, if you were to, you know, see the number of times that we each do something, we would look insane. You know, what are we doing? And this opportunity, at least on a weekend retreat, it is so beautiful to allow yourself the ease to not be immersed in any distraction. It's a bit like, you know, our minds are so agitated. And someone described it once like a kettle that is always on a stove and it's always boiling, agitated. And the practice takes the mind off of the stove. There's so many things that we do that basically puts the mind right back on this agitated field. Every time we turn on our phone, every time we mindlessly, you know, surf, check the news and the impact on our attention, it's an agitation. And this is not to say that we really will over time include everything into our practice. You know, I don't want to give you the idea that you cannot be mindful on your device, to be mindful while you're reading, mindful while you're typing on the computer. But as far as the gift of being in retreat and as a training to really support the environment that allows this continuity and relaxed attention. And the final precept is to refrain from taking intoxicants that would cloud the mind. And this is self-evident in terms of training, that if we really want to see the way things are, when we take intoxicants for the purpose of simply escaping the moment, that doesn't allow us to be with the simplicity of our experience, the difficulty that may be arising, to really allow any lesson that might be available, to really be with it. And that is not to say anything about medications that we might be taking to support our mind and body, that those are prescribed for our health and that those should be continued, you know, and that the practice holds that sense of stability. And normally we would do a call and response of taking the refuges and precepts, but because we're on a really short retreat, Matthew and I thought we would kind of just get your consent. So just for a moment, just touch in with your intention to be here and seeing if you are aligned with the idea of refraining from taking life to the best of your ability. Training in the precept of not taken, taking that which is not given. And training in the precept to acting out sexual activity during the retreat. Refraining from false speech, needless speech during our time together. And refraining from taking intoxicants that might cloud the mind. And if you're inclined to do so, I invite you to simply bow in recognition of these precepts. May this be a support to your practice and a gift to the community. So we'd like to close out with a brief sitting. So if you like to find a comfortable posture that allows you to sit in a relaxed way. At the end of a long day, it's natural to feel tired. Just getting a sense of your internal state. Your own weather pattern of mind and heart. Just doing a sound check again. Is that okay? I don't think the sound. It can be helpful at the beginning of a sitting to just check to see if the body feels relaxed and comfortable. Allowing the eyes to be soft. If there's any extra tension in the shoulders, bringing a sense of ease. Shoulders. The stomach can soften, relax. And allowing the floor or the chair to support the posture. In a very gentle way, checking to see what you can be aware of in this moment. For some of you, it might be the breath. It maybe the experience of the body, sensations of sitting. What's already presenting itself. A very gentle way, checking to see if the mind and body feel relaxed, simply receiving the moment as it is. Trusting in the simplicity of a moment of awareness. And another moment. The practice of mindfulness can be relaxed and alert. thank you for your practice. And this will be the closing out of the evening.